Yang.
Want greatness in their society. They want greatness in their lives. And they want the greatness within them to be summoned forth by leaders they can trust. Hubert Humphrey and I pray each day that America can again be seen by her people and throughout the world as Carl Sandburg saw her in these words. He said, I see America not in the setting sun and the black night of despair ahead of us. I see America in the crimson light of a rising sun, fresh from the burning creative hand of God. I see great days ahead, great days possible to men and women of will and vision. And this is what this campaign is all about. How we can renew the sense that we are part of a great country, a generous country, where there is confidence, trust, in which the end of life is not the acquisition of personal wealth or national dominance, but the achievement of personal dignity in a nation at peace with itself. This is the dream which all Americans have always held for their country. How else does one explain the tremendous successes we've had? Oh, I speak not so much of the economic successes and the material successes, but the tremendous successes we've had, bringing multitudes of different kinds of human beings from all over the globe within the boundaries of this nation, living together, working together, developing each other's skills and talents, but also developing each other's compassion and understanding and trust and confidence. This is the way you bring peace and security and justice to a land like ours. And the successes we've had over 180 years, sure, must give us courage to continue to deal with such problems in the same way. And if we do, we have every reason to believe that we can create here what we started to build 180 years ago, free society in which every member has a hope for improving his own life and the lives of his children. Thank you so much.
Sacramento, California, October 28, 1968.
He said right here in California on November 5th of 1960 that his administration had given America the greatest peacetime progress, the greatest peacetime prosperity in all our history. Well, that isn't the way I remember it. That isn't the story told by that growth in unemployment. That isn't the story told by those three recessions. That isn't the story told of the neglect of education, health, the rebuilding of our cities, that was the mark of those 8 years. And when Mr. Kennedy, in that campaign, promised to get the country moving again out of the stagnation of those 8 years? What did Mr. Kennedy say about what did Mr. Nixon say about Mr. Kennedy's policies? Let me read from that same speech here in California. He said, "I'm deeply convinced that his programs, Mr. Kennedy's programs, are regressive and would lead us backward to economic misfortunes which we have known in the recent past and from which we have moved safely away." Hear that in his own words is his clear choice. And what did Mr. Kennedy's policies bring us? 91 unbroken months of economic growth and expansion. An increase in our national production, which in this year amounts to $400 billion over the last year of the Nixon administration. A growth which has produced for American people, and most American people, the highest standard of living that grassroots citizens have ever known in the entire history of man. A growth which has made it possible for us to double our annual investment in education, to double our annual investment in health facilities, and to double our annual investment in new industries and manufacturing plants, which create the jobs and the opportunities which we need to deal with our problems here at home. These are the policies which President Kennedy initiated. These are the policies which Democratic presidents and Democratic Congresses have implemented. And these are the policies which Mr. Nixon rejected in the 1960 campaign, as opposed to his endorsement of the 8 years which had produced three recessions, increasing unemployment, and a lesser capacity on the part of all levels of government to deal with our problems here at home. We have used our national resources in the last 8 years to help local communities solve their problems. The Economic Opportunity Program is based on community proposals and plans. It's the right decisions to move this country forward. Mr. Nixon doesn't trust the American people, and this is his basic problem. He doesn't, in his own words, think that they have the ability to make a judgment on Vietnam. He doesn't think they should have an opportunity to make a judgment between him and the vice president through a debate between the candidates. And his running mate, Mr. Agnew, would deny the poor a right to participate in decisions about their own future. Now I say to you that what they represent is old-fashioned Republican paternalism, where the man who owns the town calls the shot. Well, Americans, anybody, own their future or own the apparatus which makes the policies that shape their future. I think the American people made it clear long ago, and especially in this year of protest and dissent, that they don't want to be told what to do. They don't want to be told to stay in their place. They don't want to be told to be suspicious of those who are different from them. They don't want to be told that the only thing that matters is protecting what you have. The American people want to be challenged. Challenge to build a greater America where they can be at peace with the world and at peace with themselves here at home. The Vice President and I can't promise instant success in dealing with all these problems. But we promise you that we will work at them in the activist, determined, sense of urgency sort of way that has been a hallmark of the Democratic Party over the last quarter of a century. And I'll tell you what our priorities are. First, to end the war in Vietnam on terms. On terms which give the people of South Vietnam the chance to build their own country. Secondly, to restore communications between Americans of different groups, not only by appealing to their finest instincts, but by giving all Americans an opportunity to work in our democracy as equal partners.
Really making a prediction, because I realize that between now and November 5th, there's a lot of work to do. The Vice President and I don't intend to spare an ounce of energy or a minute of any day in doing this work. The thing that encourages us is that everywhere we go, there's just a rising level of interest and excitement and enthusiasm on the part of workers and people, even those not involved directly in our campaign. You get a feel from it that just keeps you going. You feel it all across the country. Yesterday I left St. Paul in the morning, and in the course of the day spoke in Cheyenne, Salt Lake City, Portland, Oregon, and Seattle, Washington. And all along the trail, there was this feeling. It's the difference between night and day that we sense now and that we sense even 2 weeks ago.
KHJ Television, Hollywood, California, October 28, 1968.
Different problems, different country to deal with, a different kind of country to deal with. Partially as a result of the events of the past 4 or 5 years, but also partially as the result of the fact that our country has continued its evolution from a sparsely populated agrarian society into a crowded, industrial, heavily urbanized society. And this evolutionary trend has brought us to that point where, which many societies have faced in the past and not successfully moved into. This is, I think, is the great challenge. We've done some important things in the last 4 years to lay the basis for dealing with these problems. But now we've got to find new policies, new ways of dealing with them, new ways to establish relationships between citizens and leaders and their governmental institutions. Every administration has to be different than the administration before it in an evolving America.
Many people were, you know, under the impression that we might just get more of the same. But you have some very strong opinions, I'm very much aware, Senator. And
excuse me, one of them I would like to ask about immediately, Senator, really the question that's been bothering the most is, I know that most of us want out of Vietnam, but I don't feel that any of us really want to, will stand for the escalating that I feel, and I think others feel, that is really necessary for the victory. So in what direction will we be going the next 12 or 15 months if the Democratic Party should get in?
It's difficult to be as complete in one's answer to that question, Maria, with the talks going on in Paris, because no one wants to pull the rug out under from under any possibility that we may have in those talks and ending the fighting, at least, before January 20th. But our policy should be one, I think, of maintaining our military posture there, convincing the other side they cannot win a military victory, and thus gradually
scaling down
and generating the pressure toward a negotiated settlement. I think the only sensible answer to that problem down there is negotiations. It takes two to do it, and when they feel the pressure, I've got an idea that the fact we're involved in an election campaign sort of limits the possibilities right now of moving the other side.
I get the impression that the Democrats and the Republicans are saying very much the same thing on this, and the one issue seems to be the bombing halt, where opinion can be divided there, if anywhere. Some people say that a bombing halt would cost the lives of American troops. Mr. Humphrey said the bombing halt would save the lives of American troops in the long run. How can we as voters decide, Senator?
Well, risks... Well, you've really asked me two questions. Let me take that one first.
All right.
With the talks going on, obviously every presidential candidate is limited in what he might say about what he would do. No one of them can be president now. If any one of them is president, it will be after January 20th. So there is a limitation. But there is a record which each has made over the whole period of his entire public life, which gives you some clues, important clues, as to what his thrust would be when he was president. The vice president has been a man of peace ever since he entered the United States Senate. He pioneered with the Peace Corps, with the Food for Peace Program, the Disarmament Agency, the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. All of these bear the marks of his handiwork and his basic conviction about what our role in the world ought to be. And that role ought to be a drive toward increasing accommodation among peoples, different kinds of peoples on Earth. Now, Mr. Nixon's thrust in a quarter of a century of public life has always been on the sort of military, national security, anti-communist, conspiratorial view of the world. In other words, his emphasis has been always on the military side of the our role in the world. Mr. Wallace, of course, hasn't got a record in international affairs, but in his selection of his vice president, he certainly indicated that his thrust would be on the military side rather than otherwise. So you have these clues.
Well, are you telling us, sir, that the Democrats don't believe that communism poses the same military threat to us that the Republicans believe? Would you kind of go into that area a little bit? How are we now threatened by communism at home and abroad? Or are we?
Well, I think we must always be alert to the possibility of communist aggression and subversion. But I think we all ought also to understand that the world is evolving not only for us, but for the communists. Evolutionary forces are at work inside their own borders as well as outside their borders.
Excuse me for interrupting you, Senator. We have a commercial, but when we come back, I know we only have 1 week left, the Democrats and the Republicans, and I know and we all know how the polls stand on. I'm interested in, neither candidate is a stranger to telethon technique. I know there is going to be one the night before, and I'm wondering, do you think that this will be fertile ground for Mr. Humphrey? After we come back from this word from Jack Bailey Coppins.
The program.
The best answer is to make a comparison between the 8 years in which Mr. Nixon was vice president and the 8 years that have passed since. In those 8 years, we had three national recessions, which cost us $175 billion in production. This had its obvious impact upon the lives of the individual citizen, but it also greatly limited our capacity to build the schools, the health facilities, and indeed the manufacturing plants, which are part of a growing economy. And Mr. Nixon has said in this campaign that he's ready to be held fully accountable for the policies of those 8 years and what they produced. Well, now, since then, we've increased our national production from $500 billion to $864 billion. This has made possible the highest standard of living Americans have ever known. It has made it possible for us to double our annual investment in education, to double our annual investment in health facilities, to double our annual investment in new industries and manufacturing plants. And we are paying $16 billion less in taxes than we would be if the rates, which were in effect when Mr. Nixon left office as vice president, were still in effect. In other words, by the astute use of tax policy, we've been able to stimulate the growth of the economy, enlarged our capacity to provide needed public service, and at the same time improve the lives of our people. Now, I'll take the record of those 8 years over the record of the previous 8 years.
Thank you, caller.
Thank you.
You're on tempo with Senator Edmund Muskie. What is your question, please? Hello, caller.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. I believe you have your television volume on. Turn it down and ask your question, please. All right, we'll have to move along.
Hello?
You're on tempo with Senator Muskie. What is your question, please?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I'd like to know if they're doing anything, the government, about the smog problem.
The smog problem.
Well, all right, yes. This is a particular concern here, sir.
Yes, this happens to be a field in which I've been particularly active. Some of the legislation is complex, but let me say these things. First of all, we've enacted national legislation to control automobile exhausts. Now, we followed in our national legislation the experience and the things that California had learned in this field in the Los Angeles area, and we've translated that into national policy. This should be of help. In addition, we've given the national government authority to move into any area where there is a direct impact upon health from smog to roll back whatever effluents may be contributing to it. Thirdly, we've enacted legislation to create air pollution control regions throughout the country wherever smog is a problem, with a mandate to state and local government in those regions to establish controls. But failing there doing so, the national government has power to do it.
I don't really think smog is a campaign issue, except maybe in this city. We're going to have a word from Blue Ribbon Foods and then be right back.
Everything I said, that is not an accurate reflection of my meaning. What happened, first of all, and Mr. Agnew insists upon distorting this, and his comments upon the incident, was at the University of Southern California. And three students, I assume, came down front, held up a piece of paper, and each lit the paper and burned it. Not one of them said it was a draft card. Not one of them implied it was a draft
card. Probably a grocery list.
What they were doing, obviously, was something which would they hoped would dramatize what they were saying, but they did not say it was a draft card. As a matter of fact, if it were a draft card, with the FBI and people who were present as part of security, they'd have been taking some risks. And so nobody knows. Nobody says they were draft cards. There's no evidence that they were draft cards. That's the first point. But the question that accompanied it was whether a student was justified in burning his draft card or in any other way violating the draft law. And I said, well, obviously, it's the option of any citizen to break a law. I don't know how you pass a law to prohibit breaking laws. That if a citizen does, he's got to accept the full penalties which are applicable. And this is my view, this was Senator Kennedy's view, this is anybody's view, because we've got to have an organized society. I said further that if we were to permit every citizen to take the law into his own hands in this way, we'd have anarchy. And that we can't permit. And finally, I pointed out that indeed those who break the law to dramatize their protest would lose the dramatic impact of what they did if they didn't suffer the penalty. Because then they'd be simply anarchy. And when I said that I did not quarrel with it, in the full context of what else I said, I was saying that I can understand that any citizen has this option if he chooses to exercise it.
Senators, I spent the month of September in Vietnam, so it's still on my mind quite a bit. You can't visit those hospitals and not have it stay with you a long time, in spite of people thinking you should talk about other things. And in the current issue of Reader's Digest, there's an article that's entitled "The Blood-Red Hands of Ho Chi Minh." And it says that the North Vietnamese have used a form of genocide that has taken at least 60,000 lives. This is killing every educator and village chieftain throughout all South Vietnam. And I've referred to Senator Vice President Humphrey's statement 2 years ago in Australia that you can't have a coalition government because it's like letting the fox into the chicken house. Can we look for a consistency of that type of resistance to a coalition government if he wins the presidency?
Well, I think there are two aspects to the answer to that question. First of all, the key, I think, to an ultimate political settlement in South Vietnam is free elections, adequately safeguarded so that every citizen, every South Vietnamese, has a voice in deciding the future of that country. Now, if those free elections incorporate members of the National Liberation Front, then I think we've got to accept that, provided they're truly free elections. But the question really arises about, with respect to the transition government, between the end of the, between the ceasefire, if someone is negotiated, and the time when free elections can be held. And this is going to be a troublesome one to work out, because a negotiated settlement obviously implies that each side has got to feel that its interests are represented in some way in the settlement. Hanoi, obviously, would like to have one Vietnam under the domination of Ho Chi Minh's government. What the South Vietnamese would like is a fully independent South Vietnam without any interference from the North at all or any participation by the National Liberation Front. And so the question is, that would be before the negotiators when we get to that point, and I pray we get to that point before long, is what the transition government will consist of.
Now,
we must make sure of this, that the transition government isn't so constituted that it can dilute the possibilities of free elections adequately safeguarded, because that's the key to ultimately safeguarding the people of South Vietnam. The transition government may have to be one that's under the supervision of an international agency of some kind in order to assure those safeguards. But understandably, both sides are going to want to be represented in some way in that transition government, and that's a point we'll have to negotiate.
But we can't force the government of the South to do that because they consider them gangsters and terrorists.
No, excuse me, gentlemen, we'll have to interrupt for this commercial word from
promoted by Governor Wallace. Do you feel that this election could go into the House of Representatives in January?
I'm afraid that possibility exists. I pray that it won't. I think that the election ought to be decided on November 5th if we're to avoid a long period of tension and anxiety and unrest in the country. And so I would hope that everyone watching this here would decide to vote for either Mr. Humphrey or Mr. Nixon, preferably for Mr. Humphrey, but not for Mr. Wallace.
Shouldn't the representatives, if it does go into the House, vote for the majority candidate so that we've got a man that the majority of people...
I think you've got... Suppose that the difference is one electoral vote. You've got to look at the composition of the support of each of the top candidates, I think, before you can answer that question.
We're going to try to accommodate a few more of our viewers. Sir, you're on the air with Senator Muskie. What is your question, please?
Yes, I'd like to ask the Senator, in what way does he intend to negotiate the war in Vietnam from the way that has been negotiated so far? That is to say, how does he intend to bring about a halt to the war in Vietnam and not just have it keep going for another, say, 4 or 5 years?
All right, why don't you hang up for an answer? Thank you.
Well, in order to answer that question, I'd have to disclose what I know about the current negotiations in Paris, and I simply am not free to do that.
Very good, sir. You're on tempo with Senator Muskie. What is your question, please?
Yes, I'd like to ask Senator Muskie a question about national defense, specifically about in regards to Cuba. Does Cuba have any Russian advisors or Russian bombers or any missiles at this time?
All right. Would you hang up for an answer? Thank you.
Well, I can't be as specific as I suspect you'd like me to be. I don't know of any Russian military posture in Cuba which poses a threat to us at the present time. Whether or not the Cuban army has Russian advisors is simply a question I don't have the information on which to base an answer.
All right, sir. You're on tempo with Senator Edmund Muskie. What is your question?
Yes, Mr. Muskie, I'd like to have your comment on the reports which were in the press regarding the fact that you were not admitting the fact you were from Polish descent.
Okay, thank you, caller. Hang up for an answer.
Well, I certainly never expected that kind of an answer. I think it's been very well advertised.
I'm of Polish descent,
both sides of my family. My father was an immigrant himself.
What was
my
his
mother,
name, sir?
Stefan Marczyszewski. And my mother was the son of Polish immigrant, the daughter of Polish immigrants. So I'm completely Polish, and I think that's a rather well-known fact.
Indeed. Senator, we're flat out of time, regrettably, but...
KNXT, Hollywood, California, October 28, 1968.
Burbank this afternoon for a one-day whirlwind campaign tour to the Los Angeles area.
Muskie's first California stop was in Sacramento, where he spoke to supporters from the steps of the Capitol.
Yesterday marked an important event in this campaign, one that we've been waiting 2 years to see and hear. Mr. Nixon's appearance on a national interview program.
So far, all very encouraging.
Did it stronger, you think?
Very much so.
Any real facts behind that?
You're right, sir. Well, as New York Daily News call us today.
Tonight, Muskie will attend a rally.
Muskie rally at the Santa Monica Auditorium, October 28, 1968.
Provide a better life for his family, to educate his children, and to set aside something for his old age. But more important, that increased production and growth has made it possible for us to double our annual investment in education, to double our annual investment in health facilities, to double our annual investment in new industries, in manufacturing plants, which create the jobs and the opportunities, not only for those who already have a stake in our society, but for those who do not. It's this concept of economic growth and expanding America which has created opportunity for us, for the descendants of immigrants who were taken in, and it is this concept which will build the America of tomorrow, which will provide a real chance for every American. And it's easy to understand why they are impatient. In the first place, by beginning this experiment with the objectives I described, we did not instantly achieve. We simply embarked on the task of working toward it. And we've never yet achieved in 180 years as fully as we need to build the kind of society we want. Unresponsive to their voices. So what is the answer? The answer is to return to our original objective. And this is the question that we face in this year 1968. How do we reform and reshape our structure of government here in a way that will make it clear people of a crowded society that they are significant, that they do have a role to play in shaping the forces which shape their own lives, that they do have a role to play in the policy-making decisions of our society? This is a great challenge. It's a challenge that no society has ever really met. It's the tendency of every society for the affluent to grow more affluent, for the poor to grow more poor, for the gap between the two to widen and deepen. And when it gets wide enough and deep enough, explosion results. Jefferson understood this back in the beginning, and he predicted that when we were crowded, our system would really be tested. Well, we're now in the time that Jefferson feared. We ultimately reach. We now face the test, which he wasn't sure we could meet, here in the year 1968. This isn't a problem that was created by Democrats. It isn't a problem that was created by Republicans. Although the policies of each of the two parties have been more or less relevant to the question of whether we solve the problem or not. And the only party which has really understood this historic problem which we face in the last 8 years has been the Democratic Party, because we've undertaken to deal with these social problems in our cities, which prompt individual citizens to feel hopeless and without recourse in their homes. We've undertaken to try to create housing programs, job-building programs, educational programs, programs to stimulate the growth of our economy, all for the purpose of raising the level of opportunity so that more could share in it. This has been the objective. Now, in the 60s, the gap between the affluent and the poor has become more visible. With the help of television, the store windows, communication, rapid travel. And because it has become more evident, those who are outside the mainstream are more impatient with the pace of our progress. And that's why in the 1960s, you had the restlessness, the dissent, and the protest. And the protests of the young are understandable. They never knew economic insecurity. The youngsters in our college don't remember it. All they know is that as we've gained affluence, all we've gained are material things, and they're not satisfied with material things. Greatest potential strength for good that any country has ever assembled within its borders. Whether you measure it by economic strength or by military strength, or the strength that comes out of 180 years of experience in the practice of freedom. We've got the strength, and we've built it because we've been willing to gamble that individual human beings were capable of greatness. And so Americans welcomed 40 million immigrants from overseas, conferred its blessings upon them, but in the process was enriched by them, by their developed skills and talents, by their hearts and minds, by the cultures of the old world they brought here with them, by their courage, dedication to liberty. So, together, immigrants, descendants of immigrants, the Americans who are already here, united to build this great country. This strength wasn't built with bricks and mortar. It wasn't built with machines. It was built by people, the kind of people who are created by a free society. All the skills that it takes to run this country came out of people. All the compassion that has made it possible for different kinds of people to live together has come out of people. All of the planning, all of the vision, all of the wisdom that has made it possible for us as a country to reach a pinnacle no other country ever has come from its people. Well, why then in 1968 should we for an instant considering dividing the people or shielding the affluent from the poor? That isn't the answer. It has never worked anywhere else. It can't work here. We know what has worked here. So let's have some faith in our own medicine. One ingredient that's essential to the operation of a free society is contained in one word, trust. And I'm talking about the kind of trust that's willing to take a chance on the other fellow. Because unless you're willing to take a chance, there's no trust. We've got to be willing to trust those who may prove to be evil. We've got to be willing to trust those who may prove to be weak. We've got to be willing to trust those misguided souls who, lashing out against injustice, strike out at friends as well as foes. Because that's the nature of trust. That's the nature of human beings. I don't know of any other way to do it. If we're not willing to take a chance on each other, this society isn't going to work for any of us. Trust, the kind of thing you see in a man's eye, the kind of thing you see in his face, you feel in the grip of his hand, the kind of thing that persuades you to buy a life insurance policy from an agent. I was going to say a used car. And you know, people do respond to this. That's why I don't think that Wallace vote's going to amount to much on November 5th. That's why I think people are responding to Hubert Humphrey. I don't know if anybody... whoever looked in his eyes or his face, or listened to the tone of his voice, or the sincerity of his manner, or gripped his hand, who can't help but trust that man. Trust is especially important this year because there are no pat answers to these problems. You take the problems of the cities. You can't create housing on the scale that we need it overnight. You can't create jobs on the scale that we need them overnight. You can't improve schools on the scale that we need to overnight. And yet the disadvantaged have got to be assured. They've got to be assured that this is the purpose of the American people. There's only one thing that's going to reassure them. Trust. And you can get trust in your leader if you pick the right one. And if the American people elect the right leader, the disadvantaged will trust them.